सो अतिव्रज्य मुनिम अपि परस्ताद्यध्रुवगतिर् विष्णो पदम अथाव्रज त्रिलोकीं देवयानेन सोऽतिव्रज मुनिन्नपि परस्ताद्यध्रुवगतिर् विष्णो पदम अथाभ्यगात् त्रिलोकीं
थ्री प्लैनेटरी सिस्टम्स
देवयानेन
बाय द ट्रांसेंडेंटल एयरप्लेन
सह
ध्रुव
अतिव्रज
हैविंग सरपास्ड
मुनि
Great sages,
api,
even.
Parastat,
beyond.
Yat,
which.
Dhruvagati,
Dhruva who attained permanent life.
Vishnu,
of Lord Vishnu.
Padam,
abode.
Atha,
then.
Abhyagat,
achieved. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta, Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Dhruva Maharaj thus surpassed the seven planetary systems of the great sages, who are known as Saptarishis. Beyond that region, he achieved the transcendental situation of permanent life in the planet where Lord Vishnu lives. Purport. The airport was piloted by the two chief associates of Lord Vishnu named Sunanda and Nanda. Only such spiritual astronauts can pilot their airplane beyond the seven planets and arrive in the region of eternal blissful life. It is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita also, Parasasmatu Bhavanyo, Bhagavad Gita 8.20, that beyond this planetary system begins the spiritual sky, where everything is permanent and blissful. The planets there are known as Vishnu Loka or Vaikuntha Loka. Only there can one get an eternal, blissful life of knowledge. Below Vaikuntha Loka is the material universe where Lord Brahma and others in Brahma Loka can live until the annihilation of the universe. But that life is not permanent. That is also confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, A Brahma Bhuna Lokaha. Even if one goes to the topmost planet, one cannot achieve eternal life. Only by arriving in Vaikuntha Loka can one live an eternally blissful life.
ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः नमः ॐ विष्णुपादाय कृष्णप्रेष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामी इति नामिने नमस्ते सारस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशतारिणे वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधार श्रीवासादिगौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे Hare Krishna. So today morning, we're discussing from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the fourth canto, the culmination of the pastime of Dhruva Maharaj. And yesterday also I discussed the topic. So in this purport, Srila Prabhupada is explaining how actually Dhruva has attained the supreme destination beyond that which is attained by the great sages. Saptarishis are associated with the seven planets in the celestial sky, and beyond them is the abode of Vaikuntha.
So Dhruva is attaining the ultimate destination of life, Vishnupadam. Vishnupadam, rather. So now, I was discussing the broad lessons from this pastime. Yesterday I talked about how distress, amidst distress, if you get the right direction, then that distress can actually lead to something positive in our life. And Dhruva got that direction from his mother. So I'm talking about the acronym Dhruva, D-H-R-U-V-A. So D I talked about yesterday, today I'll talk about H, humility and honesty. Now, so when Dhruva was told by his mother, now go to Vishnu and he will fulfill your desire. So he started off immediately. And when he started off, now he did not know where he was going to find Vishnu. He simply knew that it is said that Vishnu is found in the forest. So he went to the forest. And actually, at one level, it may appear as if somebody wants to know God, somebody wants to know the ultimate truth of life. How can one know it? Especially when somebody is trying to embark on a spiritual journey, there are so many organizations, so many religions, so many books, so many teachers. How does one go about finding out which is the right way, which is not the right way? So the whole process involves actually recognizing that ultimately we are not in control. Now we alone can't make things happen. It is Krishna who guides us based on whatever is his ultimate plan. And Krishna's ultimate plan means that he will guide us based on how he has a vision for our spiritual life. We are not alone in our spiritual journey. Wherever we are, actually Krishna is with us. And the important thing is not whether the path we are following is genuine or not. The important thing is whether we are genuine or not. If we are diligent, if we are sincere in wanting to know the ultimate goal of life, Krishna will guide us. Often, oh, am I on the right path or not? Maybe I'll not find the right path. Thinking this may dishearten many people from even embarking on a path. But if you understand that, ultimately it is Krishna who is the well-wisher of everyone. And he Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Hriddeshe Arjuna Tishtati. He is present in the hearts of all living beings. So he reciprocates with our desires. And to the extent we have a desire to know about life's ultimate purpose, Krishna will guide us and give us knowledge of that purpose. And this is what happens in the case of Narad Muni and Dhruva. Dhruva goes out. He wants to know God. He wants to ask something for God. But he has a sincere desire to get that thing. And for that he has a sincere desire to go to God. So in general, in every situation in life, there are certain things which are in our control and certain things which are not in our control. So this applies even in the spiritual quest. In the spiritual quest, all that we can do is we can seek. Okay, this is the path that is in front of me. Should I follow it? Should I not follow it? Now, whether that path is right or not, we don't have the absolute knowledge of that. So that way, if you see, in which aspect of life do we have a guarantee that the choice that we are making is right? When we start pursuing a career in our life. Okay, I'm going to go and take this degree, get this degree, or choose this particular path. How many of us have guarantee that that will be successful? No, we used our the best knowledge that we have, the best intelligence, the best guidance that we have, make a choice. Similarly, when say we get married, there's no guarantee that that particular choice is always going to be the best for us. But in life, just because we can't have the guarantee of the best choice, that doesn't mean we stop choosing. Isn't it? We keep acting. Whether it is education, whether it is a job, if we have 2-3 job options, which one do we choose? Now, we don't know in advance what will turn out to be the best for us. But we make a choice and we move on. So every aspect of life, we, even in ordinary life, we do take a leap of faith based on the understanding that we have. So, the same principle that there are some things in our control and some things not in our control. When we are deciding a career, when we are deciding a life partner, there is some knowledge that we have, and based on that we make some decision. Someone get to some understanding, make some decision. But there are many factors which are beyond our control, and sometimes they may work out right, sometimes they may not work out right. So risk is inherent to any major decision in life. And similarly, with respect to spiritual life also, risk is there. We may take a path and it may turn out to be not right. But it is, if we don't explore a spiritual path, any spiritual path at all, if we explore a spiritual path, there is a possibility that it may be right, there is a possibility it may be wrong. But if we don't explore any spiritual path, there is certainty that we will go wrong. Why? Because every material path ends only in one place. That is the graveyard. Your life is temporary. Nobody can deny that. So, just by sometimes, especially with respect to choosing spiritual life, you know, sometimes people say it's better to play safe. No, don't take any risks. But with respect to, if somebody thinks that by staying materialistic, I'm playing safe. No, actually one is courting the greatest danger by it. So Krishna says that we have to explore. Vita raga bhaya krodha manmaya ma upashita bahavo gyan tapasa putamat bhavamagata. So Krishna says that raga bhaya and krodha in this 4.10 in the Gita, these three dispositions or attitudes are obstacles for us to ever in the spiritual path. Raga is attachment. If I'm simply concerned, this is the world I want to enjoy, and I don't care whether anything exists beyond that or not. If we are too attached to this world, then we will not approach Krishna. If we have too much fear, I don't know what is there. Is this right? That is right? It's so confusing. Better I'll not explore that. Then also we will not go into spiritual. And krodha means we tried this, nothing works, and we become frustrated, we become cynical, and we just give up everything. It said there's a difference between a doubter and a cynic. A doubter hopes that maybe there is an answer. A cynic hopes that there is no answer. So a cynic is completely negative. So these are all obstacles in the spiritual path. Now in the case of Dhruva, he was attached. He was attached to a kingdom. But even when he was attached to a kingdom, he had faith that there is some higher being, and that higher being can help me to gain that kingdom. So when he went on the spiritual journey, he didn't even know what am I going to do when I go to the forest. But he just went. And when he went with determination, there was a higher arrangement. And by that higher arrangement, Narad Muni came to him. So when we are exploring the spiritual path, the important thing is not whether the path is genuine or not. That is definitely true. We have to look for it. But more important is whether we are genuine. What do we really want? Do we want to know the goal of life? Or do we just want somebody to pat us on the back and say, whatever goal of life you are pursuing, that is good. Just continue that. There are many teachers who do that. People go to spiritual life not to gain some higher knowledge, but simply to pacify themselves when they get agitated by the pursuit of material life. That is also okay, but that will not lead to spiritual growth. Many people treat spirituality as a shock absorber. I face this problem, I got this tension, I got that tension. If I become spiritual, I do some meditation, I practice go to some serene place, I feel peaceful. And then I can come back and pursue my materialistic goals. So for them, spirituality is simply a shock absorber in their journey along the material path of life. But spirituality, yes, it can help it can be a shock absorber. But we are underutilizing spirituality. Spirituality is meant to be not a shock absorber, but a goal transformer. It's meant to transform the very purpose of our life. to give us a higher vision and a higher purpose for our life. So now, when Dhruva goes to the forest, his goal is not yet transport. He's got a big shock in his life and he's starting off as a shock absorber. He wants something to deal with that shock. Krishna also says that the distressed are one category of people who come to him. Those who are seeking wealth are another category of people who come to him. So Dhruva is often given the example of somebody who is a wealth seeker who came to Krishna. So when he started off, all that he had was his burning desire. You know, I had to find Vishnu. And then, when he had the desire, the super soul in the heart saw that. And the super soul guided Narad Muni to come to him. Once Srila Prabhupada was giving a class in New York, and after the class on him, he said, Swami, your philosophy sounds like that of the Buddha. So Prabhupada asked him, do you follow Buddha?
No.
So Prabhupada said, follow Buddha, follow Jesus, follow Krishna. Don't just talk, follow someone. So what does it mean, don't just talk, follow someone? Now, if a path is not right, if you follow it, we'll come to know it is not right. It's like taking a medicine. If I have a disease, I take the medicine. If I take the medicine and I find I'm not cured, then I can take some other medicine. But if I keep analyzing, you know, which medicine is right, and I never take any medicine. Actually, if suppose we get some disease, and we decide, you know, how can I know whether this medicine is right or not? Therefore, I'll study. And to take the medicine, somebody says, I'll get a medical degree. You may die before you get the degree. So, we have to put faith. But so similar purpose is, don't just talk. Don't just talk. Follow someone. If it is right, it will be revealed to us. If it is not right, that will also be revealed to us. So, rather than saying that, oh, how can I know the right path and just not try anything, we have to be honest. Do I really want to know? So we may think, okay, there's this organization here, this organization here, this organization here. We may see all these as horizontal choices. Now, which one should I follow? But actually, it's not just a horizontal choice. It's a vertical choice. Whichever, with our God-given intelligence, whatever spiritual path we take up. Now, if we are doing it in the mood of service to God or to whatever higher being we have faith in, then we are actually expressing faith in God. And when we express faith in God, He will guide us forwards. So quite often, in our material life, we focus on what is in our control and just take a risk about the things that are not in our control. But when it comes to spiritual life, we worry too much about the things that are not in our control and we stop doing the things that are in our control. That's how in many places people get spiritually paralyzed because the mind misleads them. The Dhruva just trots off straight. And then Narad Muni comes to him. And Narad Muni first says to him that, oh Dhruva, where are you going? He says, you know, I want to find Vishnu. He says, why do you want to find Vishnu? He says, no. He says, I want a kingdom bigger than my father's. And then he tells what has happened to Narad Muni. And Narad Muni says, hey, Dhruva, you're just a small child. These sort of small incidents happen at home. And sometimes we are in honor, sometimes we are dishonored. Don't take it so seriously. Just go back home, everything will be alright. Now, Narad Muni is a great spiritual master. He's the guru of Vyasadeva who has composed all the Vedic literature. And he's giving you instruction. Just go back home. Dhruva says, although what you're saying is true, but I can't accept it. Because I am not on that level. It's for me, the insult is burning me so much that I can't tolerate it. So I want to rectify it. I want a kingdom bigger than my father. If you can tell me how to find Vishnu, please tell me. Otherwise, please let me go on my way. So here, Dhruva also exhibits humility and honesty. You know, he's humble. You know, I'm not on that level. Please give me an instruction that I can follow. This is the same mode of the Bhagavad, in the Bhagavad Gita also, in Krishna, from 12.8 to 12.11. He gives various levels at which you can practice bhakti. First he says, always think of me. Mayeva mana tatsva mai buddhim niveshaya yuvasishyasi mayeva ata urdvam na samshaya. He says, if you always think of me, if your mind and intelligence are fixed in me, then you will live in me. Of this there is no doubt. But then what if this, somebody can't do it? Spirituality is not a 1-0 thing. Either you do this and you are in, you don't do this, you're out. No, it's not like that. Then he says, atachittam samadhatum na shaknosi maisthiram abhyasa yogena dato mamichaptam dhananjaya. So he says that if you can't fix your mind on me, then follow the process of sadhana bhakti, by which you will gradually develop an attachment to me. And then you will be able to fix your mind on me. And then he says, what if somebody can't follow the rules of sadhana bhakti? Abhyasepya samarthosi matkarma paramo bhava madarthamapi karmani kurvan siddhim avapsisi. If you can't follow the rules of sadhana bhakti, do work for me. Do some service for me. Sometimes some people come to the temple, we tell them to chant Hare Krishna. They say, I don't want to chant. I can't chant. I don't want to chant. Whatever. Now, they may still be eager to come to temple and they may do some seva. They want to serve some prasad, clean the temple, help in the festival management. In fact, when Srila Prabhupada went to India, after he started the Krishna Consciousness Movement in America, when he went to India, at that time, most of the people who helped him were people who were, in today's language, you could say, cultural nationalists. They were people who felt that India had been subordinated by foreign invaders for so long, and now, it is these foreigners who are taking up our culture. Just see how great our culture is. And they wanted to help Prabhupada simply because they felt this was a Swami. Of course, he's a great saint, but his greatness is not just a saintliness. His greatness is also that he has made Western people follow our culture. And we see many of the people who helped Srila Prabhupada in many significant ways. None of them became disciples. None of them became committed sadhakas. Most of them became life members. And they did service. When the devotees who were from America or UK at that time, they were working in India. They didn't know how to work in India. So then these Western devotees helped them quite a bit. These Indian well-wishers, they helped them quite a bit. They did this service, that service, that service. And there was a devotee who helped Srila Prabhupada enormously in building the Juhu temple. And he was not chanting in any way. He was not following sadhana bhakti. But in many ways, he was dedicatedly helping Prabhupada. And Prabhupada told him that because you are building a house for Krishna in this world, Krishna will build a house for you in his kingdom. So Prabhupada appreciated and accepted the service which they were doing at their level. Krishna, if you can't follow sadhana bhakti, then work for me. Mat karma paramo bhava madartham api karmani kurvan siddhim apapsisi. And then he says, if you can't work for me also, then at least give up the fruits of your work for some good cause. And tatah kuru yata atmavan. In this way, become situated in selflessness. So Krishna is in this way giving us various levels at which we can practice bhakti. And from these levels, everybody can advance upwards and ultimately attain Krishna. So, sometimes when we are practicing bhakti or when we are sharing bhakti, we may have a very digital understanding of bhakti. Digital understanding means, if you are doing this, 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 you are a devotee. If you are not doing this, this, you are a non-devotee. Or you are a deviant. Or you are a demon. You can go to various levels in labeling people. And the label depends not on what people are doing, but it depends on how different what they are doing is from our conception of what is bhakti. So if I think this is bhakti and if you are not doing this, that means you are wrong. But bhakti is much bigger than our conception of. So if we look at the broad history of our movement, Prabhupada started in America and at that time, the movement was primarily a monastic movement. To become a devotee meant to move into the temple. Men, women, they all moved into the temple. Even if they got married, most of them stayed in the temple. So at that time, becoming a devotee meant physically moving into the temple. And when Srila Prabhupada came to India, there were many pious Indians who supported him. But none of them were interested in moving into the temple. And Prabhupada engaged them at their level. So if we consider bhakti practice to be like a pyramid. Now pyramid at the top is thin, at the bottom it is very broad. So at the top, we could say somewhere near the top are the pure devotees who are always absorbed in Krishna. That's the 12.8 level. They're always thinking of Krishna. Mind and intellect is absorbed in Krishna. Below that is the 12.9 level. Where is that practice in sadhana bhakti? Below that is the 12.10 level where people are doing seva. They may not be following sadhana very strictly, but they are doing some seva. So if we see, if we take this hierarchy, initially when people became devotees in America, it was, they just became sadhakas, 12.9. And of course they didn't become sadhakas, many of them thought that we have become siddhas also. They thought, now we have become pure devotees. You know, many Prabhupada disciples told me that, at that time we felt that, you know, the way the movement was spreading, in a few days, we are going to take over the world. And in a few months, we are all going to go back to God. So, that was their anticipation. So, it was not, the way they practiced it was, of course, very enthusiastic. But it was somewhat unrealistic. And it turned out that the way they were practicing was also not very sustainable. So, that is one level of practice of bhakti. And when Prabhupada came to India, he saw that it was, when Prabhupada left from India in 1964-65, at that time he had been trying to share Krishna Bhakti with people for almost 40 years. And he had not been very successful. So it is not that after 5-6 years when Prabhupada came back to India, suddenly Indians had become receptive to Krishna Bhakti. No, that lack of receptivity that was there in 1965, that was there in 1970 also. But what had changed was the dynamic of cultural nationalism came into play. That before that, it was, you know, okay, there are so many Swamis in India. This Swami is also another Swami. But now he's a Swami who's gone abroad and made people in the West of the disciples. We want to help him. We want to join his movement. And many people became life members. So Prabhupada created this system called life members. And life members means, actually, to become an initiated devotee, there's a huge level of commitment. Four regular principles, chant 16 rounds, do sadhana bhakti. For life members, Prabhupada said, all of them just give some financial contribution, and then they have the facility to come and stay in the temple, and they are given Prabhupada's books. So now, if you see, that means if you consider this pyramid, life members would be way, way at the lower end of the pyramid. The pure devotees would be at the top, the sadhakas would be somewhere in between. But Prabhupada accepted and appreciated the life members also. In fact, Prabhupada, when he was in India, he would go to so many people's houses every day, meet them, talk with them, take a little prasad, give them some spiritual wisdom, and then they would become life members. And that's how Srila Prabhupada affected positively so many people. And I had gone to an important VIP kind of person's house, and then he had a long nameplate with his degrees. Now this degree, that degree, that degree, that degree. And there I saw, he had written also, ISKCON life member. So at that time, in the 1970s, the Krishna consciousness movement was such a sensation that being a life member of ISKCON was seen as a very prestigious thing. And people felt proud. Oh, I'm associated with this movement as a life member. And Prabhupada, let them have that pride. Let them have that connection at a level that they were comfortable. And they will get elevated gradually. So, sometimes if we have a digital understanding of bhakti, then those who can come to the level of bhakti of a serious sadhaka, we accept them. And those who don't come, we push them so much. We push them so that they can come inside. But they don't want to come inside, so our pushing makes them go away.
It's like we are pushing them to come in. It says somebody at the door. They're looking in. What is inside the temple? I don't know. Come in, come in. Say, no, I don't know. Come in, come in. So we keep pulling them or pushing them to come in. What happens? They just say, I don't want to be pushed. So just go away. So there are many people who will be happy to practice bhakti at the level they are at. They'll do some seva, they'll come to temple, have darshan, they'll attend some satsang. Now naturally, it is good for them if they rise to a higher level. But if they are not able to rise to a higher level, that does not make them bad people. Okay, they are that level, and everybody is at a different level in their spiritual evolution. And from that, even at that level, if they practice, gradually they will grow. And they will come to a higher level eventually. But if we push them too much and they can't practice at that level also, and they feel fried out, then what happens? That even the gradual spiritual advancement that they were making, that also will stop. So, yes, if somebody is practicing at a higher level, they will make greater advancement. We could say that. But still, we have to be real. Now, can we practice at that higher level? If it is not possible for us to practice at that higher level, then artificially imagining that I'm at that level, that doesn't lead to spiritual advancement. So, it's a simple example. If somebody says, you know, I'm going to fast nirjal on Ekadashi. Okay, that person fasts nirjal, but then they're chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, and the mind is saying Prasad, 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 Hare Krishna, Prasad, 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 Hare Krishna, Prasad, Prasad, Prasad. But the mind chanting Prasad, Prasad, Prasad is much more forceful than the chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. So, okay, we may fast, but how much spiritual advancement we may make by that? It's better to take some food and then again come back and chant. So we have to practice bhakti at a level that works for us. And that doesn't mean that we neglect progressing to a higher level. That doesn't mean we reject the higher levels. But it just means that we have to understand what we can do. You may say it is surrender. Okay, whatever I am told to do, I'll do that. That is surrender. Yes, it is surrender. But if we are really surrendering, then we should do what we are told to do. Many times, we say we will do it, but then we are not able to do it. And then it doesn't lead to much spiritual advancement. And there are some fundamental differences between, say, Indian culture, or Eastern culture and Western culture. So I was at a company in America. I was giving a talk. And then the person asked something, so I nodded my head. So then he told me, what does your nod mean? I said, yeah, I agree with you. He says, no. He says, I have learned that in dealing with Indians, a nod means nothing. A nod is just like, hmm. So he said, when Indians say yes, it just means, okay, go on. So what comes after yes is the real answer. So what happens is that sometimes we say, yes, I'll practice at this level. But we are not practicing at that level. And then we don't make much spiritual advancement by that. So here Dhruva is honest. He says, you know, I cannot practice at this level. And Narada Muni appreciates him for that. In fact, even before that, what Narada Muni says is that Aho Kshatriya Tejasam Mana Bhangam Amrishatam. When he hears about how Dhruva, a 5-year-old child, has left home, he's amazed and he says, just see the character of the Kshatriyas, that Aho Kshatriya Tejasam, just see their splendor, that Mana Bhangam Amrishatam. That they cannot tolerate dishonor. Now, you say, what is glorious about that? It's actually, we are told we should tolerate dishonor. The honor, dishonor, we should serve equally. Mana, pamana, yostulya, stulya, vitrari, pakshilo. So many times, Bhagavata Krishna says, tolerate happiness and distress. Tolerate honor and dishonor. But here, Narada is appreciating how great are the Kshatriyas that they cannot tolerate dishonor. Now, what this means is, he is not simply appreciating, oh, you are so honor conscious. But rather, for Kshatriyas, their sense of honor is used to inspire them to act dharmically. There is a difference, you know, we could say there are three different words which we could use in English. There is honor, there is pride, and there is arrogance. So, These all may seem similar, but there is a difference. Now, nowadays, many times the word pride is seen in a positive sense. There may be hotel executive pride. You know, so they say pride. Pride is considered positive. Suppose, say, a cricket series is going on, and then, say, one team has already lost the series. When the final match is there, they say, we will play for pride. We pray for pride means we don't want to be whitewashed. So, pride is not used usually the same sense as arrogance. Arrogance means one is very pompous, self-righteous, disrespectful to others, too full of themselves. So the word pride, we have to see in what context it is used. Many contemporary authors, when they talk about the six anarthas, they don't use the word pride, they use the word arrogance. Because pride in today's parlance has positive connotation. So arrogance needs to be too filled. There's no hotel arrogance as far as I know. Anyway, arrogance has a very strong negative connotation. So now, if the sense of pride makes us do something properly, something which is right, something which you do properly, then that pride is more like honor. Prabhupada in a lecture, you know, a devotee had taken initiation and then after that he had broken the regulatory principles, stopped practicing sadhana bhakti. And then Prabhupada writes a letter to him, he says, you took a vow in front of the deities, that is your word of honor. He says, don't you have any sense of honor? How can you break your word of honor? So Prabhupada uses this word honor several times. So honor is not in an egoistic sense. The word honor is used here in the sense that, no, aren't you honorable? You should honor your word. So people who take their word seriously will also ensure that they act seriously. If they make a promise, they will keep the promise. So for Kshatriyas, the sense of honor is very deeply ingrained within them. If I make a promise, I will keep the promise. Dashrath Maharaj said that to Kayakai that I'll give you two boons. Those two boons were extremely difficult, but his word of honor made him give those boons. So honor often makes the sense of honor is a way the Kshatriya's abuse of power is checked. Kshatriyas have enormous power, and when they have a sense of honor, you know, I will do this, I will not do this. Then they won't abuse that power because it's okay, I have committed, I will do this. So the sense of honor is something which is used to enable them to do something positively. So if it is generally, if Kshatriyas would make a word of promise, you know, in fact, in the past, for people who were aristocrats, if somebody doubts their word, it is like doubting their character. It's an insult to them. I have made a promise, I will do it. How dare you doubt me? So nowadays, these politicians, what they do is, they make promises, and before the election, they shake their hands with us. And they shake our hands. And after the election, they shake our confidence. You know, they just don't keep their promises. But in the past, the sense of honor was very deep-rooted. And the sense of honor will inspire the Kshatriyas to act honorably. So a part of the Kshatriya makeup, every Varna, it's not a caste so much as it's a human type. Every human type has a particular psychophysical makeup. And in the psychophysical makeup of Kshatriya, tolerating dishonor is almost impossible. For us, they can tolerate great pain. An opponent may shoot arrows, and the arrows may pierce their body and it may cause pain, and they will tolerate it. But if somebody dishonors them, even a small word of dishonor becomes unbearable. For Brahmanas, on the other hand, you know, Brahmanas, they don't have the same capacity to tolerate physical pain. But dishonor, it doesn't matter. Okay, people honor, dishonor, what is the big deal? When Karna wanted to get Kshatriya education from, wanted to learn archery, he went to Parshuram. And he pretended to be a Brahmana so that he could get knowledge of archery. And then once Parshuram was lying, taking rest, and he was sleeping on, with his head on Karna's lap. At that time, an insect came and bit her. And his leg started bleeding, but Karna didn't want to disturb his mentor's sleep. So he managed to tolerate it. And then eventually, as the blood started trickling because of the insect's bite, Parshuram woke up and saw. At one level, he appreciated the service attitude. But then he said, see,
you cannot be a Brahmana. It's only a Kshatriya who can tolerate me like this.
So all of us, based on our psychophysical makeup, Kshatriyas can tolerate physical pain, but they cannot tolerate dishonor. Brahmanas, they can tolerate dishonor, but for them to tolerate too much physical pain is difficult. In Kali Yuga, most people can't tolerate anything.
They can't tolerate physical pain, they can't tolerate dishonor. So tolerance levels are unfortunately very low.
But the point I'm making is, we have to be honest about where we are at. And, you know, say somebody has insulted us, or somebody has done something which we found offensive, insulting, hurtful. If it is hurting us, we can't wish it away. Everything's alright. For some people it may be alright, some people it may not be alright. Now that doesn't mean that we have to go and hit those people back again. But we have to do what it takes to address our particular wounds. So if we are emotionally wounded, then we have to be real. But this is hurting me too much. We have to find somebody who can understand us, empathize with us, and then help us grow thereby. So here, Dhruva, by his honesty, what happens? Narada doesn't say, you are so impudent, you are rejecting my instructions. He says, he gives him an instruction at his level. And even by that instruction, Dhruva attains perfection. So it is not that perfection can be attained only when one follows a particular level of instruction. Perfection can be attained from wherever we are at. So the important thing is that from where we are, we take steps forward. Suppose, say, we are driving. And, say, we are going for a program. And somebody calls us and asks, how far are you? I say, I'm 30 miles away, it will take me around 25 minutes. But we are expected there in 5 minutes. And then you say, I'm almost there, I'll be there in 5 minutes. If I say, I'll be there in 5 minutes, then I'm actually 30 miles away. And they start giving us guidance. You're here, take this left turn, take that right turn. Now, that guidance is useless because we are 30 miles away. So their guidance will be of no use to us. And even if we try to follow that guidance, it will not take us anywhere. Because that guidance is at that point of the journey. So if we tell them, I'm here, then they'll say, this is the path you can take from here. So imagining that we are further than where we are, that is not going to lead to spiritual advancement. We have to understand where we are, and from there we take things forward. Now, of course, there's a danger that we may start thinking that, this is where I am, and this is where I will stay. I can't do anything. I can't do anything more. But then that would mean we will stagnate in our spiritual life. We are not talking here about stagnating or rationalizing our lethargy. It is just that we have to acknowledge where we are so that we can take a step forward. Like in school. Now, a student, somebody may say, go from one country to another country, and in all countries, the educational standards are not at the same level. So sometimes a student goes from one country to another country, say in the previous country the educational standards were very low, and this country the standards are very high. The student may externally be in, say, third level, fourth level, but the fourth level student in this country has much more knowledge than the fourth level student in this country. So the student has to acknowledge, this is where I am. And then maybe take some extra classes, get some extra coaching, and then come along. So if the student says, no, this is so difficult, I can't study, so I'll not study, then the student will not grow at all. So if we are in the second level, we do the study so that from the second level we go to third level. It's not that, I can't study and I'll stay at the second level forever. We're not talking about rationalizing our stagnation in our spiritual life by saying, I can't do anything more. It means that from where we are, we move forwards in our spiritual life. And when we do that, we'll find that spiritual life will not feel too much of a demand. It will not be too demanding, but it will be fulfilling. We'll feel that we are moving forwards and we will grow holistically in our life. Just as Dhruva, by practicing bhakti from where he was, ultimately attained perfection. So in tomorrow's class, I will talk about the two next series. Realization, how we realize the Lord, and reconciliation, how he reconciled with his father and his stepmother when he went back. So I'll summarize what I spoke today. I spoke here about how Dhruva Maharaj who is right now above in this verse is that he attained the supreme perfection of Vaikuntha. That journey began with humility and honesty. So when people are about to start a spiritual journey, they feel there are so many paths. How do I know my path? How do I know which path is right? So the important thing is not which path, whether the path is right. The important thing is whether we are right. That means whether we really have a desire to know. Whether we simply want to, or somebody to pat us on the back for the journey which we are taking, or somebody we want somebody to show us the right way. So spirituality is not meant to be a shock absorber. It is meant to be a goal transformer. And even if somebody comes initially as a to absorb the shock or tolerate the shock, but eventually their goal needs to change. That's what happens with Dhruva Maharaj. And so Dhruva, initially when he went off, he didn't know where I'm going to find Vishnu. But Vishnu knew where he was, and Vishnu arranged for Narada to come. That was Lord Vishnu's kindness. So in every field in life, there are always things which are not in our control. We don't know whether they will work out. And we take some education, we take a job, when we get married. There are things which are not in our control. But we, using our best intelligence, take a leap of faith. Similarly, within the spiritual path also, we take a leap of faith based on what we know. And then Krishna will work out the rest. So, Narada Muni, when he told Dhruva to tolerate, he said, I can't do it. So, I talked about how Prabhupada also allowed people to practice bhakti at various levels. For initially, if we consider bhakti to be like a pyramid, initially bhakti, practicing bhakti meant just moving into the temple. And that's what people, devotees did in America. But they couldn't sustain it for many years after Prabhupada departed from the world. And then Prabhupada came to India, people were not interested in that. So they wanted to simply serve out of a mood of a cultural nationalistic fervor. And Prabhupada engaged them by helping them become life members and letting them serve at their level. So on the pyramid, if we see bhakti not as a digital practice, this is right and that is wrong. Rather, there are various levels, like I talked from 12.8 to 12.11 in the Bhagavad Gita. So different people can fit at different levels. So if you push people too much to a higher level, they may get frustrated and just go away in time. So we may end up pushing them away from Krishna in our zeal to push them towards Krishna. So we have to, each of us, understand what level we can practice bhakti sustainably. And that means we have to understand where we are and take steps forward from there. So this is not defiance. It is simply honesty. We are not rationalizing where we are and staying where we are. But we are actually acknowledging where we are so that we can take steps forward from there. And from wherever we are, if we keep practicing bhakti steadily, we will grow and ultimately attain perfection, as Dhruva Maharaj has in this verse. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, please.
Just on that point that you were mentioning, as far as in the 70s and 80s, the devotees were overzealous in a sense, but they got things done, which was very much appreciated.
Yes.
We can see that, as you were saying, due to circumstances and people anticipating their own consciousness, nowadays we see that there is not as much vibrancy in the actual growth of the movement. The need is there, but it seems to some extent that people are complacent in their Krishna consciousness when they can actually do more. Prabhupada was of the mind in the 70s, he pushed the devotees. He consciously pushed the devotees. If someone had an idea, let me open up a center, he'd say, go do it. Irrespective of their qualification. And then the results were there. Because as you were saying, like Guru Maharaj actually went and did it like that. So this point of apathy is a thing that actually we have to address in this country at this point of time. Recently I was travelling in regional Victoria. There is so much opportunity for preaching in all these different centres. And in the early days, yes, we thought we could take over the world, and it was only a question of time. And that was a reality to us. But now it seems to be fleeting. And I'm just wondering, how do we address that apathy? You know, that contentment only happy in that temple, we're doing our sadhana and everything. But Prabhupada's move was push, because the panacea for the sick of the society is us. We should do something more than what we're doing.
So the zeal for sharing Krishna Bhakti was there in the past. That is lacking into the lot. There's quite a bit of apathy. The people are satisfied with simply their own practice of bhakti. Although there is so much scope for outreach. What can be done about this? I'd say that this will be my understanding is that the three disciplined aspects to it. First is that different people themselves have different natures. If we consider the broad bhakti tradition of India, how many missionaries were there? If you look at Chaitanya Charitamrita, Chaitanya Bhagavat, the devotees would chant Hare Krishna and they would do kirtans. But in general, most people are not missionaries. Most people are not very concerned about the big world and changing the world. It's not necessarily that they're selfish. It is just that that is not the way they think or they work. Even in the outside world, you see that there are some people who are very socially conscious. Oh, we have to do environmental activism, we have to take care of this, we have to take care of that. And there are many people, okay, I'll do this, but not more than this. And some people not care for it. So you say that zeal or activism is something which is present in some people, it's not present in some people. That's the way the demographic of the outer world is. And when people come to the Krishna consciousness movement, to some extent, the demography of the Krishna consciousness movement will also reflect the outer world. So there will be some people who will have a lot of zeal, but they will always be in the minority. Just as outside of the people, social reformers or that kind of thing, they're not many. Now, in one sense, we could say Srila Prabhupada, when he went to America, largely that was the mood and that was the kind of people he attracted. The hippies were not just reformers, they were revolutionaries. Reformers means they come to a building and they say, actually this painting is not good, we'll change this. This decoration is not good, we'll change this. So reformers, gradual change. Revolutionary means blow up this building only, we'll build a new building. That's the mood of revolutionaries. So, see, in the initial days of our movement, we attracted that kind of people who had that revolutionary zeal. So naturally, the outreach happened much, much more. So I would say that the kind of people we attract, that also matters a lot. And it's not that people who are not having that active zeal, they are bad. It's just the way they are. Now we may say that by the contact with Prabhupada and the contact with Krishna through Srila Prabhupada, there are many devotees who had no activist zeal earlier, but now they are developing that zeal. There's one devotee who told me that he almost every day he goes to the institution now. Before he became a devotee, he said, even in college, if there is a group of 5-6 people, I'll be afraid to talk over there. He was such a reserved person. But now he's read, even the people, he knew those people, still he was apprehensive of talking with them. He's going and talking to unfamiliar people. So to some extent, that transformation does happen. But it's not that original nature can be entirely changed. So there are some people, you know, they basically need order and stability in their life. And some people need adventure and newness in their life. And that is the basic need. So those who are revolutionaries, they need adventure and newness. Oh, go to a new place, start a center, meet new people, do this, do that. And there are some people who need order and structure. So for example, within bhakti, both of them can be accommodated. So for example, we have deity worship. And in deity worship, there is spiritual newness. But there is, at a material level, order and structure. Come on, do this on time, do this on time, do this on time. And those who are doing deity worship are also doing a valuable service. So everybody, by Srila Prabhupada's inspiration, will develop some activism. But if some devotees don't develop that spirit of zeal for sharing, then that could be because their inner nature is that they need more order and structure. So there are many devotees, in our movement I've seen, devotees who
who are traveling preachers. There are some devotees who like to speak to new people. And there are some devotees who like to speak to devotees. And those who like to speak to devotees, often they may become teachers. Bhakti Shastri teachers, Bhakti Vaibhav teachers. And for them, they need a structure, a pattern. And then they will take the education forward. Some people just go to new people, answer challenging questions, meet different kinds of people. That's what. So even in an activity as specific as teaching, there could be the need for order and structure, and there could be the need for newness and adventure. And devotees will find the vocation, find their particular engagement accordingly. So those who are, say, teaching to insiders, you may say they are not having that much zeal to go out, but they are doing service accordingly. So I would say as our movement becomes bigger, we also need to find out how we can engage people according to their nature. So everybody may not have the zeal for activism, but they can also be channeled, their energy can be channeled in service. Certainly everybody needs to be pushed. Prabhupada himself said that, my spiritual master pushed me, I am pushing you, you push others. Ours is a pushing parampara. So, a pushing is definitely required. But it has to be done in such a way that people don't feel alienated by that. It's a subtle line. Sometimes pushing inspires us to do something, and sometimes this pushing just becomes unbearable. So if we are sensitive, then we will be able to understand when that line is being crossed. That's the first level, first point. The second point is that actually this apathy or the not eagerness to share, I think it's also a product of culture. In the sense that many devotees will be happy to share if they are provided the facilities by which they can share. That means that, suppose, if we educate and train devotees, you know, okay, when you face questions, these are where you can answer the questions. Now, if you have to talk with people, this is the way you can talk with people. If you want to start some outreach, how can you do it? Many times, if the training is not there, the devotees try once, twice, thrice. They try to share Krishna Bhakti with someone. They ask some difficult question and then they become, you know, this doesn't work, I'll not share it. So, basically, if we provide the training and the facility by which devotees can share, then many devotees will take it up. So, for example, if we have some structured facility for training, okay, if you want to answer questions, if you want to reach out to new people, these are the kind of questions people ask, and this is how you can answer those questions. So, if we have some training program for devotees who are doing outreach, and then what happens by that? The devotees feel empowered. Otherwise, they feel people ask such questions, I don't know the answers. Now, some devotees may have the zeal to go around and look, where can I find the answers? But many devotees, they may not have that. So often it is not so much that devotees are apathetic, but they feel unequipped. And this especially happens, now our movement has become largely Indian. And Indians feel comfortable reaching out to Indians. But Indians find it difficult to reach out to non-Indians. It's not that they don't want to, but it just doesn't happen. Because the culture is so different, the upbringing, the way of thinking is so different. So I have not seen across the world many Indian devotees actually being able to reach out to Western. But there are a few devotees who have done that, but they have had to put in a lot of effort, they have to connect with other devotees who are successful in Western outreach, and then do that. So, in one sense, even in the Western world as well as in India, the movement is growing, but it is growing among Indians. So it's largely, if you consider comparatively speaking, as compared to other spiritual movements, the Krishna consciousness movement is growing quite fast. It's growing big in India, and the West also among Indians is growing reasonably fast. But, so it's not that devotees don't have zeal, it's just that they're not equal. So we need special training to equip devotees for Western outreach. Or rather the outreach in the place where they are at. You see, Prabhupada himself, you know, Prabhupada was special that he could reach out to so many Western people. But even Srila Prabhupada, after the first few years, he actually left his Western outreach to his Western disciples. After 1971-72 onwards, Prabhupada spent most of his time in India. Because Prabhupada could have done whatever he had wanted. Krishna would have empowered him. But if we see what Prabhupada did, the Prabhupada let Western outreach be done by Western disciples. And he focused on India. There's a practical reason also that he found that his Western disciples were being cheated by Indians. Because the Indians would flee thinking that Westerners mean they have a lot of money. And they would charge 10 times the average rate. And the devotees from America would think, hey, this is 10 times less than the American rate. So they would think we got it very cheap. And they would actually be spending a lot of money. So there was an demonic, like a nickname which they had. The Indian dealers were dealing with Western devotees. They said, these are damn cheap babus. I mean, they think they are getting it damn cheap, but we are actually giving them very expensive to them. So Prabhupada practically had to stay in India. So we need some amount of training for how to do outreach in a way that is accessible to the contemporary culture. So that revolutionary phase that when Srila Prabhupada was there, that has ended now. The hippie movement, the counterculture, that is no longer there. So the way the preaching happened at that time, it will not work now. I was at a seminary in India, a Christian seminary. They invited me to speak. And there, they had a seven-year course by which these Indians were converted to Christianity. They would become fathers. And this is what they said, I'm a brother now, in 1 year I'll become a father. So, but the important point was that in the 7 year syllabus, they told me that actually 70% of their studies are about Hinduism and 30% is about Christianity. Now, of course, they're not studying Hinduism to understand Hinduism so that they can practice it. They're studying it to understand it so that they can refute it and present Christianity. But that aspect of studying the native culture so that we can present things appropriately, that's just one aspect of training. So I feel if devotees are equipped, trained, then outreach will happen. But till that point, just if we see, okay, we may go for Harina, we may go for distribution, and all this is important. But in terms of attracting Western people to become devotees, we will need not just the awareness that we are here, but there will be a step-by-step process. How can they become devotees? What is required for them? How can they be trained? How can we be trained to help them in their journey? The training would be the second aspect. The third aspect is that the situation in the movement right now is that actually, as I said, initially there were the devotees who were staying inside the temple. So the movement was mostly monastic. That was what was there in America. And India, it was mostly life members. So you could say that the monastics, they were at a higher level and the life members at a lower level. Now today, most of our movement is neither there nor there. Most of our movement is neither monastics nor life members. Our movement is largely congregation-based. So congregation-based means that everybody has their family, everybody has their career, everybody has their social responsibilities. And we need to, so we cannot expect people who are at this level to practice at this level. So those are congregation members, they cannot share the way, say, those who are monastic were sharing. But at the same time, they are not at this level of life members. They just want to come to the temple and occasionally do nothing else. So we need to recalibrate so that devotees who are members of the congregation, at their level, how best they can share Krishna. If we expect those who are congregation members to try to practice and share Krishna Bhakti the way those who were in the monastery earlier, those who were monastics earlier, that is not going to work. So even devotees who stayed for some time in the temple, they were introduced to Krishna Bhakti in the temple and they go out afterwards and they live in the world. But their understanding and experience of Krishna Bhakti is different from those who have never lived in the temple, those who grew up in a family setting. So for that, the level of the congregation, we need to recalibrate the expectations and then offer avenues by which people can do outreach at that level. So, yes, that's my broad answer.
No, thank you very much, and I appreciate your answer. The point that you made about the fact that there is not that revolutionary zeal anymore, I would contradict that, because actually there is. If you look at a Pentecostal or a born-again Christian community, they're not necessarily monastic,
okay,
but they have a very, very
strong
zeal to press on their religion. So it is there. Mm. It's how do we imbibe that zeal again within our congregation? You know what I mean?
Okay,
it's
yeah.
Like it is there. If people are convinced about their faith and they feel so strongly that they want to pass that on to someone else, say for example with the evangelistic born-again Christians, I don't know if you've had contact with them, but they are determined. You know, if you see what they're doing around the world, they have congregations of thousands of people, young people, enthusiastically wanting to surrender and dedicate their life to Jesus in that way. It is, and that is the sort of thing that we as leaders also should be, like Prabhupada, encouraging that pushing quality. Because, I mean, we have the panacea for, we have the greatest knowledge.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so evangelical, say Pentecostal and others, they have that zeal where they're sharing. Yes, that is true. When I said that that revolutionary zeal is not there, what I primarily meant was that the hippie or the counterculture was a phase in the Western culture. That is not there right now. But there are always people who have that missionary zeal. I know people who, you know, Western people who come to India, and they go to villages in India and just they live lifelong in the village. And they just become like fathers of that village, and the whole village becomes converted. So when we say, oh, they're converting Indians, converting Hindus to Christianity, we may be alarmed by that. But at another level, we can appreciate their dedication. For somebody who's been born in America to go and live in a village in India is not easy. So there are definitely people who have that dedication. And at one level, we also have many devotees of that nature. But we could say that in terms of number, that number may not be that much. And that zeal has to be activated primarily. Ultimately, one person, one human being can influence another human being only in three ways. You can provide knowledge, set example, and provide facilities. So we provide knowledge of Prabhupada's example. We share more and more about the adventures of sharing Krishna consciousness all over the world. And that lights a zeal. Now, so actually Prabhupada's example itself is a big, the more we read about Prabhupada, the more we will want to share Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada's life is all about sharing Krishna consciousness. The knowledge is one thing. Second is that we set the example ourselves. If we are trying our best to share Krishna Bhakti with others, then people see that example and they also catch that. And most of the times, those devotees who have that zeal, they've got it from somewhere. Maybe in the formative years of their Krishna consciousness, saw someone. Okay, this person is doing so much, I also want to do so much. And the last is facilities. So by these, if we provide these three things more and more, people will take it up. And it becomes like a, we could say a positive contagion. Positive contagion means once some devotees start doing their outreach, then others start doing it. Then others start doing it. And then it will grow more and more. Yes, certainly in that sense, the zeal which many devotees had earlier, that is lesser, and we do need to stress that. Thank you. Yes.
Prabhuji, how to absorb in the lotus feet of Krishna? For example, Rupa Goswami says, always remember Krishna, never forget him.
Hmm.
And Mahaprabhu says, Naam Ruchi, Jeevdaya, and Dharam Seva. So your experience, how to absorb our mind in the lotus feet of Krishna, please.
Yeah, okay. So how to absorb ourselves in Krishna? And there are two things in this, in my small understanding. First is that it is very difficult to ourselves always have that motivation to stay absorbed. That is why we need some responsibility, some obligation, some commitment that forces us to absorb ourselves in Krishna. Like a simple example, if I'm told, okay, you know, read Prabhupada's books daily, yeah, I will want to read them. But if I'm told, okay, tomorrow you have to speak on this verse, then I'll read Prabhupada's books much more carefully, because I have to speak on it. If I have to speak on, say, I have to teach the Bhagavatam first canto or whatever, then I'll read the first canto much more seriously than when I would read it just for my reading. So, in general, for most of us, to do some service, to get absorbed in it, the absorption can come through attraction. Oh, I love this so much, I'll get absorbed. And if we are at that level of attraction, that's wonderful. But if that attraction is not there, then there has to be some kind of obligation. Not obligation in the sense of burden, but a responsibility or a commitment. So the best way we absorb ourselves in Krishna is by taking responsibility for Krishna. Suppose if I decide, I'm going to do some service in deity worship. Okay, these days I'm going to come and do that. Then that responsibility forces us to put our mind on Krishna. So if we decide that, okay, I want to every day read Bhagavad. But some days I feel like reading, some days I don't feel like reading. But then how do I do this? How can I make sure that I read every day? So I may decide that now one advantage is that of the social media and the technology is that outreach has become democratized. You know, anybody who wants, they can start outreach. So I know several devotees and I encourage them also that you want to read Bhagavatam every day. They say just, you know, start, make your own small group on WhatsApp. Say that every day I will post one point from my reading over there. And just for posting that one point, you will have to read. Isn't it? So, when we do something with the knowledge that we have, that inspires us to take the knowledge more seriously. So, this applies to study and this applies to other services also. So, we try to find some way in which we can create a commitment for ourselves. So, that is what will lead to the steady practice of bhakti, that will lead to purification, that will lead to attraction, and then the absorption will become spontaneous. Right now, the absorption has to be conscientious. So conscientious means we have to consciously do that by creating some commitment. And second is that we have to find out that what are the activities in bhakti that we can be absorbed in most easily or most effectively. If I think this is the circle of bhakti and this is the circle of my interests and likes, so I find the intersection between the two. Then, if I situate myself in the intersection, absorbing myself over there will be easy. If somebody likes to read, and they will already have that habit. So for them, if you tell them to do deity worship, they will do it. But for them to get absorbed in that will be difficult. But if they have to read, they get absorbed in reading. So both finding out how what we can most naturally do in bhakti according to our interests and creating some commitment for ourselves.
What you are talking is Raganuga Bhakti.
Yes, we will come to Raganuga Bhakti by the steady practice of sadhana bhakti at our level wherever we are. Thank you. Okay, it's already... Okay, so...
thank you so much for the nice class. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. You stated about preaching zeal. Last year I was with His Holiness Bhakti Vidyapur Maharaj. And he's a Gurukul, you know, leader in Mayapur. And he attributed certain points from the Shastras why the preaching gets slackened. So he said the first reason is avidya itself, which means when we don't have enough confidence in our knowledge, then we feel hesitant to tell others because we feel that if somebody comes up with this, you know, how will we answer? And he said that is with the most of the people who are not inclined to learn more and more in terms of knowledge. The second reason he attributed it is due to lack of compassion. So he said, as per Shishtavashtakam also, when we get the knowledge, we feel, okay, this is good. But we don't feel compassionate towards other jivas that they should also have this knowledge and feel liberated. Because somewhere down the line, we are all very self-centered, full of ourselves. We have no compassion. compassion for the others. And why Prabhupada went all the way, Maharaj said, was when he had association with Srila Prabhupada, is because he had huge amount of compassion towards everyone. Similarly, Mahaprabhu had a huge amount of compassion towards everyone, that the Harinam should be given to everyone. And then Maharaj said that why the compassion doesn't come is because our heart is tuned. So he said, and our heart is steel framed because we are not ready to lose our old habits. We always have a competing scenario that I have to be the best, you know, at some level, right? So if I get this knowledge, the other gets the knowledge, you know. And he said, with Indians, the most biggest problem is that when we get at the level of a teacher, we have a lot of attachments. And he said, the attachment means, I give one class, I have 7 devotees, I look after them. You will not think of, okay, expanding this whole concentric circle. You'll get stuck, okay, this is my class, this is me, I'm the one who is teaching them. So let me help them. But they will not think of a panoramic way. And Maharaj said that if you look at it, there are many stalwarts even today who do a lot of Western or cross-cultural preaching. He was talking about His Holiness Radha Govind Maharaj, who goes to Dubai and a lot of Muslim countries to do preaching at times. And many Western sannyasis doing preaching in India and Indian sannyasis doing preaching. And he said the same spark can be taken up by their disciples, that how their spiritual masters are doing in a similar fashion, in a selfless way. So that is how he explained to us at that time of preaching.
Thank you. So, keep properly the priority. Thank you very much. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhaktavinda ki, Gaur Premada.